Welcome to the podcast series for AJP Heart and Circulatory Physiology. I'm your host, Kara Hansel-Kehan. Today we'll discuss the article by Salavatian et al. Titled Thoracic Spinal Cord Neuromodulation Obtuns Dorsal Root Ganglion Afferent Neuronal Transduction of the Ischemic Ventricle. This article was published September 20th, 2019. Joining me today are Editor-in-Chief Irv Zucker, Lead Author Jeffrey Ardell, and Content Expert Mark Kaufman. Let's get started.
Thank you, Kara. Welcome, everybody, to this interesting discussion of this paper. So as everybody knows, cardiac spinal afferents innervate the left ventricle and are sensitive to a variety of substances that are released from the myocardium during coronary ischemia. The cell bodies of these afferents reside in the thoracic dorsal root ganglia, or the DRGs, which in turn send projections to the dorsal horn of the spinal cord. The consequences of cardiac spinal afferent activation are twofold. First, they transmit the sensation of cardiac pain, or what's commonly called angina. And second, they activate a sympathoexcitatory reflex, and if this is prolonged, can generate or contribute to life-threatening arrhythmias. Thus brings us to the current study. Jeff, would you please describe the rationale for the current study and what your group found?
I'd be glad to, Irv. The main objective of this study was to understand if we could use a very specific neuromodulation, which in this case was dorsal column stimulation from the T1 to T4 area, to change the sensory transduction of the ischemic ventricle. The methodology basically relied on placing very small electrodes into the dorsal root ganglia, identifying those neurons which responded to transient ischemic events on the heart, and then evaluating their response before and after the spinal cord stimulation. The main finding of the paper was that preemptive spinal cord stimulation can reduce the afferent signal coming from the ischemic ventricle as transduced by the dorsal root ganglia. And the data primarily points to the fact that this result is the fact that we change probably the substrate utilization within the heart and thereby change what is being sensed. It's not silent ischemia, it's changing the sense profile.
Thanks, Jeff. Mark, I know you for many years have studied the activity of small diameter afferents, especially from skeletal muscle, especially as they relate to the genesis of the exercise pressor reflex and thereby sympathoexcitation. I wonder if you could comment on Jeff's findings and how spinal cord stimulation per se can be used to modulate sympathetic function in a more global way.
As I was reading your paper, Jeff, I was wondering if the spinal cord stimulation could also be used to modulate some of the increases in blood pressure seen during exercise in patients with peripheral artery disease, especially those with claudication. That is, they have pain in their legs, which is where the atherosclerotic plaques build up and prevent blood flow from going to the muscles. Especially in claudication, would it prevent some of the pain seen in that and some of the very large increases in blood pressure we see in these patients?
I think it's highly likely that it would. There's actually a long history of spinal cord stimulation for various types of back pain and other types of pain. There's actually quite an active area of investigation in terms of the traditional spinal cord stimulation, which is at the 50 hertz, with people sometimes getting up into the kilohertz range with these stimulations. But it does have a long history and actually has a potential application in that setting.
Have they made measurements of pain ratings from these patients or measured their blood pressure responses to exercise before and after spinal cord stimulation?
There is some nice studies with spinal cord stimulation with respect to angina. And what they basically found with the exercise stress test is that if you had the spinal cord stimulation on, the patients could actually exercise to much higher levels. And at the time that they started to perceive pain is when you started to see the ST segment deviations on the EKG. So that indicated when the signal got strong enough, you would still perceive it. My prediction is that you'd find the same thing within the lower spinal cord for that type of pain, but you'd have to place the electrodes, obviously, within the correct dermatomes.
Jeff, that's a great point. I'm trying to visualize what the cellular mechanism is here, and I'd like your thoughts on this. Are we talking about a type of intervention that occludes the activity of dorsal root ganglia into the dorsal horn simply by high-frequency stimulation, or is there another pathway that modulates the afferent input itself?
That's a very good question, Irv. First of all, I'd like to start by stating that there's always been controversy with the spinal cord stimulation for cardiac. Are you doing an anadromic activation of the dorsal root ganglion causing afferents to act as efferents, or are you changing the efferent projection pathways? Our data from this paper indicates it's not an anadromic activation. In conjunction with other data we have, I think it really has to do with changing the processes of reflexes within interthoracic sympathetic ganglia, within intrinsic cardiac ganglia, and at the myocyte nerve interfaces itself. It remains to be determined exactly what is going on in terms of the myocytes themselves, but we do know from previous work we've done that if you essentially do the spinal cord stimulation, you alter both PKC and PKA pathways, which are important for the cardioprotection, and that you can block those with beta blockade and alpha blockade. So it really does seem that there's something fundamentally going on at the myocyte, which alters its response to stress.
That's probably the more interesting concept. Mark, any comments or questions?
I was wondering, Jeff, if you think that there's any role for opioids in this attenuation of the response.
Yes. If you look at some of the initial work that Carol Williams and I did that showed opioid modulation between the dorsal horn itself in terms of the modulation of the afferent input coming in. And that's actually when we did both thoracic spinal cord stimulation, and also we did some stuff with high cervical to thoracic cord. Those studies were also published in AJP probably about 15 years ago.
Do you have a sense of what happens to sympathetic outflow to the heart during spinal cord stimulation?
Yes, it actually is blooded. We've actually done direct recordings from the middle cervical and stellate ganglia, and in response to the stress of myocardial ischemia, the activation in the stellate middle cervical is reduced. We actually just had another paper accepted yesterday where we did direct measurements of catecholamines within the ventricle, and we found that in response to spinal cord stimulation, we could reduce the amount of catecholamine released during the ischemic stress by 2/3.
Any involvement of the vagus at all?
Potentially, yes, because of its major influence in terms of modulating sympathetic parasympathetic interaction, both by ganglionic interactions at the end effector. You will note that the paper I just talked about with the catecholamine release was done in the setting of vagotomy. So that certainly could be an important consideration and something that everyone should always keep in mind when they do these types of experiments.
I mean, I think there's a lot of implications here in terms of therapy. I was just wondering, in this particular study, you activated the spinal cord stimulus before the short-term occlusion. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And what happens if you do the occlusion, wait a period of time, and then activate the spinal cord stimulus?
What we found previously is that spinal cord stimulation has a memory function with it, which is around 30 minutes. So it could actually have a residual effect even after you turned it on. What we have found previously, though, is that if you try to look at the cardioprotective influences against infarct size, it really has to be on preemptively instead of in a reactive mode.
Right. Mark, anything further?
It seems that your work really lays a strong foundation for a clinical trial.
Oh, goodness, yes. And actually, it's a little discouraging because spinal cord stimulation was quite the thing in Europe 15, 20 years ago, but it's actually falling off in terms of usage because of all the advances in other therapies. But certainly, the neuromodulation is in a critical area in terms of moving forward. I think if you look to some of the work you've done, you look at some of the work that Irv has done, with the cardiac afferents. I mean, this is the future of cardiotherapy.
And I think that with new types of electrodes and some of those that you use now, especially the flexible electrodes, this is going to be much more acceptable in the translational and patient world.
That's exactly right. And the SPARC initiative from NIH actually is now moving into major clinical focuses now with specific grants into that range, which numerous groups, including ours, are being funded to pursue going forward.
Well, this has been a really great discussion of a paper that I think lays the groundwork for a lot of food for thought. And hopefully your group and others will take this to the next level very soon so that we can move this into the clinic. I want to thank both Jeff and Mark for their involvement in this podcast. And now we'll turn it back to Kara.
You've been listening to the AJP Heart and Circulatory Physiology podcast series. For more podcasts like this one, visit us online at physiology.org/journal/AJP Heart. Keep listening for more from Jeff, Mark, and Irv to hear what happened after we wrapped the official recording.
Kara, could I just ask Jeff a question off, you know, out of the podcast? I'm just curious about something.
You can ask anything, Mark.
If you were to electrically stimulate the dorsal roots, you know, antidromically, could you cause a coronary vasodilation like you can for the axon reflex in skin and muscle?
That's actually a good question. Actually, the reason I did the antidromic activation stuff because my friend and colleague, Bank Linderoff, actually did some nice studies where he stimulated the dorsal root ganglia and was looking at a skin flap ischemic model and basically found nice vasodilation mediated by CGRP.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And we didn't see that.
Certainly, if you activate these endings with capsaicin or other types of TRPV1 activators, you get an enormous vasodilation.
Has that been published, Irv?
Not really, but maybe in other systems, I can't think of it. But when we do this in the lab, and especially when we use RTX, we see a huge increase in superficial blood flow that's completely blocked with a substance P or an NK1 antagonist.
That RTX is a bomb. Works.
Right. We did a study where Kingman was first author a number of years ago, about 15 years ago, and we basically found that SCS did not change the blood profile distribution in response to the ischemic stress. Mm-hmm.
Because you're not doing anything antidromically. Why?
Well, I'm not sure antidromically. What I'm saying is that, you know, there was when the people who did the angina stuff were doing thing, they did this big song and dance about changing between supply and demand. Mm-hmm. And that study was done to show if there was any change in supply, and there wasn't. But the caveat being those were normal animals. We didn't do anything in chronically infarcted animals.
I see.
Yeah. Great. Great to try this in conscious animals or...
We are, sir.
Yeah, good. Good.
We actually have another grant on this where we're looking at changes in spinal cord processing between normal infarcted animals and also what happens when you do the neuromodulation interventions.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic.
I got another paper to send to you in about a week or so on this. So
that's even better.